It's easy to assume that everything is fine with your pet, but like they say, an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound of cure. And during National Pet Cancer Awareness Month, that's important to keep in mind. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time every month, as a matter of fact, to spend with us to give us some advice on how to keep your pet healthy in mind. Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
It is nice to be back.
Well, losing a pet can be very hard, and you recently experienced that.
Oh, I did. It was a week ago Sunday, and my tears, I mean, believe it or not, they still happen at random times, but Bulldozer, and I think they're going to try to post a picture of him up on the Facebook page, passed away acutely a week ago Sunday. He was normal. I mean, he's a 10, almost 11-year-old male bulldog, healthy as can be, had virtually no medical problems. Had some dental work done in the spring, and other than that, fine. And, you know, he got up in the morning and he was fine. I went to work at our local dog fair here in Madison and came back 4 hours later. And during that time, he had vomited and then started to develop a little breathing troubles. We got him in the car. I was taking him to my colleagues at the vet school and he died on the way in. It was literally less than a 4 hour start to finish. So what's your average owner or veterinarian who's an owner going to think? What did I miss? Is it something I could have prevented? And, you know, when there's no symptoms, what are you going to do about it? And that is where the role of having a necropsy, or in the human world, we call them an autopsy done.
Yeah.
And I spent 24 hours in agony going, wow, you know, what did I miss? And, you know, I'm a horrible veterinarian. I even got messages from my daughter who, in her way of grieving, was mad at me saying it was something that I missed. Well, turns out I found out the next day from one of my colleagues who did the autopsy that he had an 8-centimeter, which is about a little under 4-inch mass in his heart. He had a heart-based tumor that was inoperable. And so, you know, when you find out something like that, yeah, you still lost the pet, but it makes me realize that, you know, he lived right up until the end with not showing any symptoms. If I had known about it before, I think I probably would have been treating him very differently, you know, and maybe a little more carefully or whatever. But again, he lived his life to the fullest, and I am so grateful that I got that answer. So when people lose a pet, I really highly recommend that you talk to your veterinarian about getting an autopsy done. It really helps with closure. You're still going to miss them, but it just gives you that sense of relief that, all right, you know, Mother Nature took over out of my hands. So that's my feeling on that. And because it's National Pet Cancer Awareness Month, I thought it was a good idea to just bring up the fact that sometimes cancer just shows up randomly, but there are a lot of symptoms of things that may help point us in that direction, that it's something that needs to be looked out. First of all, if you have an older animal, they're much more common, obviously, in aged animals, but any new lumps or bumps or changes in the skin, like we had a dog in recently that had a form of skin cancer, cutaneous lymphoma, that was looking like it was a skin infection, but it was just acting really odd. You know, weight loss, changes, you know, sometimes it's things like breathing or coughing. One of my technicians just recently lost her dog to lung cancer, and they had thought, because the dog had heart disease and it was coughing, that it was the heart. Well, it turned out when we took a chest x-ray, it was actually lung cancer.
Wow.
So, you know, again, these are all things that can be checked out, and there's so many innovative treatments and surgical interventions and chemotherapy and radiation therapy. You know, we've got some great oncologists here in Wisconsin, and, you know, it's the type of thing that we can definitely make pets' life better, even if they have cancer.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we always love to see photos of your pets. So please post them on my Facebook page as well. Ruth in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Well, hello, and thank you. And, Sandy, I just want to, as a listener, express my condolences about Bulldozer.
Oh, thank you.
But, you know, this is the kind of thing that I will say to all of my friends who lose pets prematurely, okay, is that actuarials will say that people are anticipated to live to be like 86 or 88 years old. Look in the newspaper, see how many do. You know, and because there's so many things that can possibly go wrong, it's a wonder that life ever goes right from conception on. And this was something that you could not have prevented, you didn't cause, and there was nothing you could change. The heartbreak is that when people who don't take their animals to the veterinarian on a regular basis find that the animal has succumbed to something that could have been prevented or could have been changed.
Right. And, you know, and when I made that recommendation of having an autopsy done, sometimes we do find things that I feel really bad about calling the owner to say, you know, your dog had a uterine infection, and if you had her spayed, that would have been helpful. That just happened recently in a case that I had. So, you know, it's sometimes it's some very simple things may have saved the pet's life and given them more time. And unfortunately, that may be a lesson for the owner. But I think more often than not, the answers we get back are more helpful.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also helpful to the students to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a parakeet that made it into the little horror book about how big can a kidney get.
Oh, my goodness. You know? Yeah.
Because he had a kidney cancer of some kind or another.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, there again, what are you going to do about it?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. There's nothing.
Right.
Nothing that could be done. And so other than to give the animal the best life possible until the time it's time to, you know, let them help them to the other side of the rainbow.
Yeah. Well, you must have friends that really appreciate you. The fact that you can, I'm going to start getting teary-eyed here. the fact that you can be like that. Sorry, I'm going to just take a break and we're going to I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. You know, I can fully understand that, having shed many tears myself for Frosty, for example. I better not talk too much either. I'll be in the same. We'll both be sitting here with handkerchiefs. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. Certainly looking forward to hearing your questions or comments for her as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or again, post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. We did have, Sandy, a question from, was it an email from Patricia, 10-and-a-half-year-old, 30-pound American Eskimo. Last year had a lithotripsy.
Lithotripsy. That's where, if you have kidney stones, where you ultrasonically remove them. Yes.
After that was performed, it was determined the stones were calcium oxalate stones. The vet who did the procedure stated she's not used to seeing these types of stones in American Eskimos. My questions are, do you think it's possible that the multivitamin he had taken for the previous 9 years may have caused the formation of the stone?
Oh, unlikely.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's on Royal Canin, so moderate calorie food, and typically this food is supposed to be given exclusively. However, because we aren't positive this food is going to help, I'm wondering if there's any type of treat which might be safe to give because he is really treat motivated.
Yeah, and this is, you know, thank goodness the veterinarian sent those stones in. We see lots of different types of bladder stones in dogs, and treatment is going to be based on what type of minerals and so on make up the stone. And definitely an American Eskimo is not one of those breeds where we go, they commonly get bladder stones. But calcium oxalate tends to be more of an inherited type problem. And so I'd be looking back in this dog's ancestry to see other dogs had issues with that. And I'm glad that your dog is on that diet. That's the SO diet. It stands for struvite oxalate. It's a moderate pH. They control the mineral levels in the food and so on to prevent those two types of stones from forming. There are some things that you may want to look into that may be helpful. I mean, I definitely think this throwing random food at your dog would be an issue. But this may be a case where if you want to, you know, shake things up a little bit, maybe make some homemade treats for your dog, I would be contacting a veterinary nutritionist. And you can find them at through the American College of Veterinary Nutritionists. They have a website. One of the ones that I refer people to is the group called BalanceIt.com. They will give you recipes for homemade diets. You have either you or your veterinarian sends in the medical report for your dog, and they'd be able to come up with things that you could be able to make for your dog that will provide them with a safe diet for the health problem. We don't want to have these stones come back again. They cannot be dissolved. They have to be surgically removed or so it's a tough stone to have to deal with. And so I'd be really careful about popping other things into this dog. It's that would be a mistake to do that. I have taken though the canned diet that goes along with the dry, and actually taken little globs of it and made almost like dog jerky by just cooking it in a slow oven so it dries out. And it doesn't keep that long. You have to keep it in the refrigerator. But a lot of dogs, just because it has a different texture and mouthfeel than the cold out of the canned food, they like it and they think they're getting something special.
We have a Facebook question from Lisa. My little poodle has an enlarged heart. Being treated is actually doing pretty well, yet I know probably the end is near. Can you talk about organ transplants in pets? If a person can get a new heart, why can't my dog?
That's a very, very good question. We do some organ transplants in animals, primarily kidney transplants. And that is something that is done really only in cats. And I think the main reason that we just don't see a lot of transplants being done in dogs is the cost of the anti-rejection drugs to use. They have to be on such high levels of a drug like cyclosporine to prevent organ rejection that it becomes extremely cost prohibitive on a daily basis to be able to keep the dog on that medication. For whatever reason, cats and humans and so on need a lower dose. Dogs just gobble it up and need such a high dose that it just does not become affordable for most owners. So eventually, you know, that may be something that may come up.
Ralph in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Appreciate your call.
Yeah. My question for the doctor is related to my golden retriever, Jessie. She's 16 years old and has lymphoma on her skin.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed these lumps for about 9 months. A couple of them have broken open, and then I treat them with salve and antibiotic ointment. And she doesn't seem to be getting a lot worse, you know, except that she can't it's very difficult for her to go up and down the stairs, go in and out. She still goes outside to the bathroom and goes outside with me, but she can't walk. So she's a lot weaker than she used to be. So she's about 16 years or 3 months old. And I guess my question is, how do you know when it's time?
You know, sometimes it's taken, the decision is taken away from you, like it happened for me. But in other cases, and this is by far the majority of our pets, we are put in that situation of having to make a decision as to when their quality of life isn't good. And there's, you know, so many things that you have to look at. It's not just, are they eating or are they able to go to the bathroom outside, but are they in pain? If they are, can you control the pain? You know, are they mentally alert? Are they still finding joy in life and that in things that, you know, maybe they can't chase after a tennis ball, but they'll lay there and you can kind of roll a ball back and forth and that may be very happy. They might make them very happy. So it's really important you kind of look at all that quality of life. And there's been a numerous quality of life scales that have been published that your veterinarian may be able to provide you with. If not, feel free to contact me at the veterinary school and I'd be glad to, you know, scan something or photocopy, you know, get it sent to you if you wish. Because I find that it's very helpful to sometimes put a number to things, you know, where that, again, that's probably the scientist in me coming out. But most of these quality of life scales will involve You know, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how is the dog's appetite and how is the pain level? And when we start, you know, seeing those numbers dropping, that's an indication that, you know, maybe their quality of life isn't good and it's time to be thinking about ending their life, which is, a really tough decision. But know that, you know, I live by the motto that I would rather have end a dog's life a week too early than let them suffer one day too long. A couple of things that you may want to look into. You mentioned that, you know, she's dealing with her cancer. It's, you know, I don't know how painful she is, if, you know, if that's being controlled. But the fact that I think your big concern is that she's having trouble getting up. And there are devices. One of my favorite things, in fact, I just had a friend, I convinced her to purchase one, and they're wonderful. It's called a Help 'em Up Harness. And you can get them, you know, online. They're actually a harness that the dog wears. It's got almost like suitcase type handles on like over the rump and up over the shoulder area so that you can help your dog up and down the stairs and support them. And that may, again, you know, put your dog back into being a little more mobile. I'm actually looking at purchasing a wagon for my old dog, Vanna, because she loves to be outside and loves to go with us, but is so arthritic. Our walks have consisted of walking down to the end of the driveway and back, and yet I know she wants to go further. So we're thinking of getting a wagon for and taking her for a little stroll around the neighborhood that way, so which will improve her quality of life, too. So
that's
good.
That's called a help them up harness?
Help them up harness, yes. Like help and then E-M up harness. Yep.
Because yeah, that's really the only problem she has, really, is going up and down the stairs. It's just so difficult for her. And I carry her sometimes, but she doesn't really like that. Yeah.
And being a big dog like this, that's tough. And so this would give you a little more leverage and, again, give the dog that sense of freedom. Even though you're doing a lot of the lifting, they're still using their legs, and it's less degrading that way.
Yep. Yeah.
So what's the natural course? You know, she's had this for like 9 months, and she's had the lumps for a long time, but they don't seem to be, you know, getting worse. Her weakness is getting worse.
Yeah. I mean, one, if it is lymphoma and you have had a diagnosis made that it is cutaneous lymphoma.
Yes.
Okay. That's amazing that she's lived that long. Okay. But typically without medical, you know, chemotherapy, they usually don't, I don't know the exact amount of time, but you're probably looking at a much shorter life expectancy. So yeah, I think your dog is very blessed to have lived as that long and that comfortably with it, because it can be a very painful skin disease.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah, she doesn't seem to have any pain at
good,
all.
Good, good.
Yeah, okay, well, I appreciate your help very much. Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks, Ralph. And we'll take some more calls. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Cyrus-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Definitely have some spots on our Facebook page if you have a photo of your pet or a question. I hope you'll post there at the Larry Mueller Show. Greg in Turtle Lake, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Doc.
Hi.
I'll try to get through this without.
I think it's going to be one of those shows. So everybody, get your Kleenex out. You know?
Anyway, I did have an idea. You mentioned that Help 'em Up carrier.
The harness, yeah.
And what I use, I have around the house, and it's a fabric log carrier that I carry the logs in and out with.
Uh-huh.
It's got two handles on it, and I just put it under the belly, and it works real good. It's quick, and it helps them up easy.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and we use those a lot. Like, they actually make, like, it looks like a log carrier, but it's meant for, you know, helping it, lifting an animal up. The nice thing about these harnesses is that the dog can wear it all the time. So you don't have to be shoving something under their belly. If you see them, like, struggling at the base of the stairs, you're right there. You've got handles. You can help them up. You can help lift them in the car. And, you know, the dog just wears it all the time. It's all soft and padded and comfortable. They can urinate and defecate in it. They have different designs for males and females because of their anatomy, and you have to take all kinds of body measurements to be able to make sure you get the right size. But in a pinch, definitely what you're describing, even a towel or a blanket sometimes helps too, to put underneath their belly. But again, you're only supporting that one part of their body, and not, you know, front and back end as well, just kind of the middle.
Mm.
And my condolences to you and to the other pet owners.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very, very much, Gregory. I appreciate it. And we, by the way, our Sandy's dog, Dozer, who passed away, the photo is up on our Facebook page. And there's also an adorable photo of three dachshunds from Joshua. So we'll take a look at those, too. And let's go to Jeff in Lone Rock next. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Larry, thanks very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's been kind of a tough year for my wife and I. In March, our beloved 12-year-old lab developed cancer in her front leg. And, you know, we went through a process of giving her painkillers and whatnot to try to see if we could get more time out of her. And then when it finally dawned on us that we were giving her the painkillers for us more than for her, we had her put down, which was very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few weeks ago, our younger lab, who was 5 years old, had started noticeably losing weight. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, she was in really good spirits and everything, but just started getting thin. And we took her into our vet, and they had said, you know, and she wasn't really eating very well. And he said, well, maybe her stomach's upset. We put her on some medication to settle her stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a week later, that didn't help, and she looked like she was still getting worse. So we took her in, and they found out that her kidneys are failing.
Oh, my goodness.
And
yeah. You know, in a young dog with kidney disease, there's a number of things that we think about. Probably on the top of my radar is a condition called leptospirosis. It's a bacteria that is spread through the urine of wildlife and other infected animals and likes to live in wet areas. And being a lab, my guess is that your dog probably spent a lot of time in the water. But that's one of the things that we would be testing for, because that is a kidney disease that we may be able to, you know, stop the progression through appropriate treatment. I had a dog in just in the last month or so that had a really nasty kidney infection, had what was called pyelonephritis, that had gone undiagnosed and treated for a period of time, and is now, you know, has kidneys that are not working up to snuff as well. So, you know, kidney disease is something that can be managed. It's trying to find the underlying cause, and if there is some therapy that can be given to help stop it. The fact that your dog, we had this length of time with him, the little delay in getting that diagnosis, that's probably, was the time that if we'd caught it early enough, we may have been able to turn some things around. But I'm so sorry. It's a hard, two dogs in 1 year, and especially one that's just at the prime of their life. You know,
yeah,
that's the hardest.
So.
I did want to mention one thing, though, is that we did the lepto test, and there was not lepto, and it wasn't a kidney infection.
Okay.
She did pass away a week ago today after trying, you know, everything, including giving her, like, Epogen to try to get her blood cell count back up.
Okay.
And, you know, after all that, you know, I think the drugs are just hard on her.
She
wasn't eating. But there was no diagnosis of really where this came from. And this all kind of, like, then got us thinking, well, did she get a hold of a Chinese dog treat?
Good of you for bringing that up. And that might be something that, unfortunately, you probably can't do anything about it now. But we've known, this has been hitting the press now pretty heavy. Since 2007, there has been lots of reports of problems with dogs getting quite ill from consuming some jerky treats that, believe it or not, are still being sold over the counter. I was in one of the big box stores this weekend, and sure enough, there they were. It typically, they, you know, it's always referred to as the chicken jerky treats, but now they're looking at duck and sweet potato as well. And a couple of them that are out there that have been implicated are the Wagon Train by Nestle Purina and the Canyon Creek Ranch, which is another Nestle Purina product, and Milo's Kitchen, which is made by Del Monte. These recalls like this can all be, and these have not been officially recalled. It's just they're suspect as being the cause of this. But there's been approximately 600 dogs in the United States that have died, and you know, several thousand that have been made quite ill with this. And the symptoms that we will see is often weight loss, vomiting, diarrhea, kidney disease, and a really oddball kidney disease called Fanconi syndrome, where they start spilling sugar through their kidneys and, you know, almost act like a diabetic, but their blood sugar is normal. We don't know the cause. The FDA has been over to China to be able, these are all China manufactured treats or contain ingredients that came from another country. We still don't know the cause. And there's now studies going on where they're looking at wanting, you know, lab work from the dogs, blood samples, jerky samples, if it's still available, you know, if the dog has passed away, their remains to be able to have an autopsy done. There's, you know, there's a huge push to be able to find, get to the bottom of this. And yet these treats are still being sold. So just, you know, really watch where the food comes from and avoid anything that's the jerky made in China.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And just to let you know, we have some open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Tim in Rosendale, thank you for calling. Well, let's see here. Get him on now. Here we go. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
See, I have an 11-month-old female lab who is in the midst of her first heat cycle, and I've been researching nonstop to figure out, do I get her spayed? Do I not get her spayed? I have no intentions to breed her, but the more research I do, the more confused I get. I know the common kind of answer is, yeah, I get them spayed before their first heat cycle for mammary cancer, but I've also found things that say, you know, it increases the chances of ACL ruptures and dysplasias and things like that. And she's a very hard-charging, hard-working hunting dog, mm-hmm. so I don't want to risk that either. And I guess I'm curious kind of where you stand on the issue and what advice you might give.
And I am just as confused as you, but here's kind of how I put it out to people. Spaying and neutering, although, you know, pet overpopulation is a huge issue in this country. If you go to another country like Europe, it's not done. I mean, they are allowed to stay intact and they only get spayed or neutered if there is a health problem where those organs need to be removed. So it's a very cultural thing in United States and Canada to do neutering. And classically, all veterinarians have been taught, hey, do it when they're before they have a heat cycle, ideally when they're 5 or 6 months of age, and, you know, get it done. And the reason why we say that is for the female dogs, primarily we don't want them to have an unwanted pregnancy. And we also get concerned about every time they have a heat cycle, you increase the risk of them developing mammary cancer. And that is one of the things that, you know, we always promote that we're going to prevent that. But there was a fairly good study that was done at UC Davis looking at golden retrievers. And obviously, they just looked at that breed. Can you extrapolate to Labrador retrievers? I'll leave that up to the scientist in you. But what they found is that dogs that were spayed after a year of age, they didn't even look at whether they had a heat cycle or not, but just after a year of age, had decreased risk of those orthopedic diseases that you mentioned, knee problems and so on. And so I am recommending to my clients that they do their own homework and that they try to figure it out. And many people are now saying, you know, I'm a conscientious owner. They're not going to get pregnant. I'm going to make sure that, you know, we, you know, keep them away from other dogs when they're in heat. And I understand the risk of breast cancer, which one heat cycle is like absolutely minimal. It's more they have more than two. It increases the risk. And consider getting them spayed at a slightly later date. And we'll see what happens. I think that until people start doing that, we're not going to have a lot of good data because we just keep following the advice that's been handed down from one generation of vets to the other. And, you know, and so I'm proud of you for waiting. I think if I had a large breed dog, I'd be waiting as well. And I'd be waiting until that we know that they're physically mature, until they're, you know, maybe over a year of age, 14, 16 months of age, ideally before they have their second heat cycle.
Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, my rationale here is I believe estrogen is partly responsible for bone density. So to pull that out before they're fully grown, to me, in my mind, doesn't really make sense. I'm no doctor or scientist.
But yeah, but it's mainly that the sex hormones are involved with growth plate closure. And so that's why when you see dogs that are spayed or neutered as very young animals before they go through puberty, tend to have longer, more gangly legs. Their growth plates eventually close. They don't continue to grow throughout their life, but they just tend to have a different conformation than dogs that are allowed to go through normal puberty and development. So, yeah, it's a very controversial topic right now.
Tim, thank you very much for calling and bringing it up, as a matter of fact. I wanted to mention we have, we've got a photo of a bladder stone from a pug, which we'll get up here in a second. And we also have a Facebook photo of a polydactyly cat. And we have a Facebook with a photo of Renee with her King Charles, who just passed away.
Oh,
so there.
Beautiful. Oh, I saw that stone go by, Larry.
Where's that stone? Yeah. Let's see if I can bring it back.
Yep. There it is. Oh, yep. Very nasty looking thing. And, you know, I hope that actually got turned in. We're really lucky that we have a stone evaluation laboratory up at University of Minnesota. And so that's where almost all of our bladder stones and things get sent for evaluation, so they can determine what they're made of and we can do the appropriate therapy.
And Mary does say that they're waiting for the results of
good.
The composition.
Okay.
So it was removed from one of the foster pugs, the bladder stone. The vet had not seen a stone like this before embedded in the bladder wall.
Yeah, that probably caused that dog to have a little bit of blood in its urine and was very painful. Yeah, I'm glad it got taken out.
Yeah, me too. And I will also mention that this is totally off the subject, but Limey, my lime tree, several people have said, would you please post a photo of Limey? That was named by my 10-year-old daughter. And I took a photo the other night, and Judith just put it up on our Facebook page. So if you want to see it, Limey, I think, and I took some limes off, but she still has, he still has three limes.
That makes some nice gin and tonics. Yeah.
And the limes are really good.
Oh.
So anyway, you want to see Limey, there's Limey. And as a sort of a pet thing, you might be able to make out the fact that there's some tin foil in the pot, and the tin foil keeps our cats Coco and Tiger out. They don't like tin foil.
Yeah, and you know they do sell kind of mesh covers that can go over plants like this, and the company that makes Sticky Paws, which goes on furniture for cats that are scratching furniture, they also make some sticky strips that you can lay across so that when the cat steps on it, it kind of pulls their hair and it's uncomfortable for them. So I love upside down mouse traps. I think all they have to do is have that go off once and they typically leave the plant alone. And you know, it's really important. I was just, again, in that same big box store, I ended up seeing that they are selling sago palms. This was something that about 6 months ago a caller brought up. They're very toxic for dogs, any part of the plant, and yet there's nothing on it. And so you brought that in, and you've got a dog that, you know, is not feeling well and goes over and is looking for something to chew on. That could kill them. So you have to know what plants you're bringing in and, you know, whether, are they safe for use around or in the home around your pet.
Regina in Campbellsport, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Dr. Sandy, would you please give some suggestions for one of our family members wants to buy a small dog, and there's just one 10-year-old in there, and the people are gone all day.
Well, okay, that would be almost like me trying to choose a spouse for somebody, okay? Mm-hmm. I always recommend that the family, before they, and this would be a perfect project for the 10-year-old, really start investigating breeds and their health problems, the cost of maintaining them, you know, being left alone all day, is that going to be appropriate for the dog? Are they going to be able to raise a puppy if they're gone all day long? Should they be looking at an adult dog that needs to be rehomed? I mean, there's lots of great small dogs out there. It's easier for me to say, okay, well, you want a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. You know, what do you know about their health issues regarding heart disease and other things that they have that are major problems for them? You know, and so doing your homework that way is really important. I think the other important thing is always working with a reputable breeder. And how do you know it's a reputable breeder? One way, they give you a lifetime guarantee. That is what I would be looking for if I was in the market to get a new dog. And what I mean by that is that they are the most conscientious breeders. They're breeding for health. They're breeding for temperament. They want to make sure that that puppy or dog is going to be raised in a home where it's going to be, you know, well socialized and cared for medically, so that the dog's off to the best start it can possibly be. If someone is just selling them a dog without investigating what kind of home that dog's going to be going in, run. I mean, that would be somebody that's just in it for the money. They are not concerned about the dog's, you know, well-being down the road. A reputable breeder would also be very willing to take the dog back and be able to rehome it if for some reason that owner can't keep the dog. Rather than seeing it go to a rescue group or whatever, humane society, which are overloaded with pets, this way they can make sure it's ensure that it's going to be in another home. They made it and it's theirs for life and you're just really borrowing it from them. Mm-hmm. So look at mom and dad and make sure that they have good temperament. I just had someone in the other day that picked up, they bought a dog and they ended up meeting the people at a parking lot outside a mall, and they exchanged money. The dog, they were handed the dog. They didn't get any information as to what was done with the dog, how it was raised. Now that, you know, really smacks of being probably in a puppy mill situation. And so, you know, good luck with getting a patient or a pet like that. So, sorry, I'm not naming breeds, but, you know, go to a dog show. That's a great way to be able to see and talk to other people that see all these dogs.
And I love the idea. Our daughter Emily is 10, and so if you have, Regina, if you have a 10-year-old in the mix here,
yeah,
have them do the research.
Oh, yeah.
Online. You can go get a lot of information online.
And I think that's really important for them to, you know, then they know kind of the care that's involved, the finances that are involved. How are they going to have the money to be able to take care of this pet? You really have to go in with it with eyes wide open and not just thinking that you want something cute and fuzzy.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We had a Facebook question from Tanya, this goes along with a photo on our Facebook page. It's a cute photo. My 8-year-old male mini dachshund has what my vet calls male pattern baldness all over his body. He doesn't scratch or itch, irritated, and the hair he does have is thick and healthy. He's on a homemade diet of boiled chicken and rice with vegetables and the Missing Link vitamin supplement because he's had pancreatic flare-ups and due to store-bought dog food being high in fat. Is his baldness linked to his pancreatic issues, and is there anything else besides the special diet?
Well, this happens to be male pattern baldness is very common in dachshunds, and I don't think it's not just males, it's males and females. I think it's just one of those things where we'll get this, you know, areas of hair loss. Sometimes their whole ventrum, their chest wall and so on becomes bald, their head becomes bald, their ears become bald, tail becomes bald, and then they have normal hair elsewhere. We always want to rule out other things that could be causing this, but the fact that the skin is normal, it's a dachshund, it's probably just this like very common problem. It's kind of like the way bulldogs will get what's called flank alopecia. That's another kind of breed related that's also seen in dobies and boxers and so on, where they'll get bald spots kind of up on either side of their back. No medical cause for it. One of the thoughts is that it can sometimes be controlled with a drug that's available over the counter called melatonin, but it may make your dog a little sleepy. So it's like, well, you know, can I buy a coat for the dog to keep him comfortable? I mean, it's a dachshund. It probably doesn't spend a lot of time outside anyways, probably under the blankets and keeping warm. Very unlikely it has anything to do with the diet, although making sure that the diet is well balanced, that you've got the right levels. You mentioned that there's a vitamin supplement, but I didn't see anything about a mineral supplement. And make sure that you've got the right calcium phosphorus balance in the food, because long term you're going to run into troubles with that. And I don't know the missing link supplement well enough to be able to say whether there's adequate levels of the minerals in that.
Email from Brian wonders if you'd please give him the name of the medicine you'd mentioned on previous shows that can be used by both dogs and cats for the tick disease. Couldn't remember if it was for Lyme or not.
I think what he's talking about is not so much for the diseases, but to prevent ticks from getting on the pet in the first place. And it's a collar that the Bayer company makes called the Seresto collar, S-E-R-E-S-T-O. It's good. It lasts for 8 months. They make them for cats and dogs exactly the same, just sized differently. And excuse me, the cat collar is a little bit more of a breakaway collar as well. But extremely safe. And so when you have a multi-species pet family, that might be a very safe alternative to use. And I've been getting really good feedback from people that are up in the heavy tick areas, especially up north, that they're really happy with how they do with it.
Excellent. Roxanne and Frederick, thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about immunity to frontline. My cats have always had frontline, and this summer, it seems to not have worked at all. It does okay on the ticks, but the fleas, it doesn't even touch.
I think instead of immunity, you're probably meaning resistance, okay? Are we seeing resistance,
sure.
Okay, to frontline?
Yeah.
And I have to say, no, I don't think we are. But what I would be looking at, number one, if you bought the frontline through your veterinarian, there is the Mariel company does give a guarantee that if you've got a flea problem and you are using it religiously once a month on all your pets in the household, that they will come and they'll send in a pest specialist, an exterminator or whatever, to be able to investigate and treat if necessary.
Okay.
What I would think is most likely causing this is, remember, any fleas that you're seeing on your pet today were actually from eggs that were laid about 2 months ago. And so we had a summer that was just beautiful for flea development. And so I think it's more the environmental stress with the number of fleas that are out there in the environment. I'd be looking around and being very careful to make sure that you don't have stray cats, wildlife like raccoons or possums that may be visiting your yard in the middle of the night. Kind of hard to be able to tell because they mostly are nocturnal. But those are probably the top three carriers of the fleas that infect our pets. And remember, anytime you've got a flea-infested animal, they're walking around like a giant salt shaker, shaking flea eggs all over the place. The fleas don't leave the pet, the eggs do. And they roll off, and within a few weeks to a couple of months, they're going to be hatching and turning into a flea that's back up on your pet again. So I don't think that it's probably, you know, the fact that that's not killing the fleas. It's just that you've got an environmental load that you just keep finding fleas on them. So be on the lookout for, you know, where they're coming from. Do you have raccoons in your attic? Do you, you know, have you dealt with the environmental, you know, looking outside to make sure that you don't have a possum living under your porch or something that could be transmitting fleas like this?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I would go first.
And thanks a lot for calling, Roxanne. Appreciate it. David in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi. David, are you there?
Hmm.
Oh, we must have lost David.
Oh, well.
Well, let's try Pat in Milwaukee. Pat, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you for calling.
I just have a question. I have a cat. He's about 3.5 years old, and about a year and a half ago, I'd say, I took him to the vet because I noticed he was limping, and he's a little bit bow-legged, but he was just always like that, so I didn't think much of it. But the vet took an x-ray, and he's got two in his hind legs deformed femoral necks, and the vet suggested that I get a double femoral head ostectomy, and they put him on glucosamine, which seemed to help a little bit, but he's limping a lot more now, and I'm just wondering if there's any alternative to surgery.
Yeah,
or
what you're what you're describing is the hip joint is a ball and socket joint, and if the ball part of the hip is deformed, and we can see this happen from genetics. I mean, we know that it's very common in breeds like the Maine Coon because they're a giant breed cat. It may be from a nutritional issue back when they were younger and their bones were developing. It may be inherited. We'll even see some vascular problems that probably more we see it in small breed dogs. It's called leg Perthes disease, actually seen in humans as well by the same name, where you get vascular problems to the that part of the hip joint, and the head of the femur just becomes, you know, all deformed. And so you can imagine having, instead of that nice smooth ball and socket rolling around in there, you've got this deformed chunk of bone that's rubbing against the socket part, and the cat's going to be uncomfortable. Glucosamine is not going to fix that. You've got an orthopedic problem that really needs to be, if it's as bad as your vet sound is making it sound, surgically addressed. The femoral head and neck osteectomy, what you're describing, is where they remove the deformed part of the hip joint, that ball part, and now the cat ends up forming just a false joint. It's amazing. These pets will go in, dogs that have had this done, and it works very well in small breed dogs and cats. Larger dogs can sometimes have a little more complications because of their extra weight, but they form a false joint. You don't have any bone-on-bone contact, and they wake up from surgery and are pretty much, wow, I'm pain-free now. And owners are just amazed that they can go home and how well they're walking very, very shortly after surgery. So I think I'd be looking down that road rather than trying to find any medical options. And, you know, there just aren't any good longstanding pain medications that we can use safely in cats. There's some that we can use for brief periods of time. There's a couple of new ones out there, but nothing like we can use in dogs that are going to be long-term pain control.
There you go. Thank you, Pat. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling. We have a kitty who's 18 years old. She's in very good health at the moment, and we expect her to live for a number of more years. But when it's her time and she passes on, we would really like to get some kittens, one or two young kittens, excuse me, just at weaning stage. And we'd like to adopt from our local Humane Society shelter because they have a lot of cats and kittens, but they will not let a kitten, they will not let an animal go out of the shelter without being spayed or neutered.
Yeah, and that's like, again, and I applaud your shelter for doing that. The reason is that there's been studies done, and I may be giving a little bit of misinformation on this, but where they looked at animals that were put up for adoption that were unspayed and neutered, and the owners were just told, bring them back in when they're 5 or 6 months of age, which is kind of the classic time that we do spays and neuters, as we talked about earlier. And it wouldn't cost you anything. You just got to bring them back in to have them spayed. And guess what? Over half of those animals never came back in. And with the goal of shelters to be decreasing the population of unwanted pets out there by adopting them, they want to make sure that they've taken the pet's reproductive capability out of an owner's hands before they ever get placed out in the public again, because they don't want these new adoptions to be adding to the pet overpopulation problem. When it comes to, you know, getting them spayed, by all means, have that done. There doesn't appear to be any huge health risks to cats. And living with a cat in heat is not fun. Living with a male cat going through puberty that's urine marking is definitely not fun. And so I applaud your shelter for having that stand. And I think that's kind of the norm that you're going to find with shelter adopted pets.
Yeah, there we go, Stella. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Trevor in Jefferson, hi.
Hi. I have a 2.5-year-old Chesapeake Bay Retriever that we hunt with on a weekly basis. I keep her nails trimmed, you know, as close to the quick as I dare go. And I've noticed recently that when we get back, her pads seem to be rubbed raw, maybe almost to the point of a bit of blood coming through where her nails touch. And I guess I'm not sure if I allowed the quick to get too long. It really isn't that long, but, you know, she just seems to have this rubbing on her pad. I don't know if a callus will form.
Yeah, unless she's got, like, really oddball nails that are curved down, even, like, dogs with longer nails, they're not going to have contact with the pad until they're, like, really, really, like, way overgrown, which I have seen. They usually will just kind of splay the toes out a little bit, and they're fine. But if we have had some deformity for whatever reason in the nail, sometimes they will contact. I've seen some pugs that have had this where their nails curve down and they have direct contact with the pad. And those are real tough ones to deal with because you trim them back as short as you can and you still have that contact. Obviously, a pug isn't out working as hard as your Chessie is. So, you know, the couple things to be looking into. One would be if it's just that she's just overdoing it and causing trauma out in the field, there are some things like there's something called Musher's Secret, which a lot of like sled dog owners use, which is an ointment that you can use on their pads to help make them a little tougher and protected. You could look into booties, although you'll probably end up having to replace them after every hunting trip because they're going to fall off. And they may not be able to perform as well. But that's very odd. And I, without actually seeing a picture of it and what her feet are, how the conformation is, I'd be hard pressed to give you any more information than what I have.
There you go. Thank you very much, Trevor, for calling. It's nice that he was talking about his Chesapeake Bay Retriever, his dog. Coming up at 2 today, speaking of dogs, on the Kathleen Dunn Show, John Katz's new book. It's called The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story. It chronicles his love for Maria, now his wife, and her fiercely protective dog, Frida. And that's today at 2 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Katz has many.
Oh, I love his books. They are just wonderful, wonderful books to
read. Yeah, they are wonderful. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine, our guest today. She's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Post a photo on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or you can ask your question there. Back after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Sandy, great to always have you with us.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
We have lots of callers online. The number to call, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Darcy in Stevens Point, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Sandy. Hello,
hi.
Larry. Sandy, I'm wondering if you can talk about staph infection of the skin for an English Springer Spaniel and how it could get out of control if it's not... if oral antibiotics are not effective.
We're seeing more and more issues. I mean, first of all, staph is kind of a normal inhabitant on the skin in low levels, and the skin is a really good barrier. And so when we have issues with skin infections, we start needing to look at, is there some underlying problem with the skin? Does the dog have allergies or external parasites or something? So I hope that that's all been looked into. And then when we do have it diagnosed as a staph infection and it doesn't respond to the classic antibiotics that we use, which are usually a cephalosporin antibiotic like cephalexin. There's another one called Clavamox, which is like Augmentin that they use in people. And it's important to make sure that when we treat with oral antibiotics, that we use one that will work against the staph and then use it long enough, which is typically 3 to 4 weeks. But if we have a really deep skin infection, it may be much longer. 6 to 8 weeks may be necessary. So it's a very long, drawn out process. if your dog has been treated with the appropriate antibiotics for the appropriate length of time and you've ruled out secondary causes, then I would start looking for a resistance problem. And this is where we would take cultures. And just like in the human world where they're seeing lots of methicillin-resistant staph infections, we're also seeing that in the veterinary world. And so when we have that diagnosed, then we have to have a total change in how we doing, how are we going to deal with this, because now we have to pull out antibiotics that are going to be, you know, much different than what we would classically use. And it, of course, we've got the risk to the human and so on. And so it's a whole different ballgame when we've diagnosed that. The push in veterinary dermatology, I was just at a meeting about a month ago, and they had a whole half day on topical therapies. And it's been something that as veterinarians, we tend to not ignore, but tend to not do as readily, because if we tell an owner we need you to have your dog bathed, you know, 3 times a week, that may be, you know, not done as because it's, you know, it's harder to do, but giving a pill, much easier. And so we've tended to drift towards more systemic therapy rather than topical. But there are some things that you can do along with, you know, oral antibiotics to help get that infection under control. And this would be involving using appropriate shampoos with, usually we're looking at a chlorhexidine-based shampoo. And make sure you're getting one from the veterinarian, because depending on how that shampoo is formulated, there are some out there that are don't work very well. And so using one that your vet has found to be quite effective, that would be something to consider. And it does have to be done frequently. Sometimes between bathing days, we'll use a topical chlorhexidine spray. We've been also been getting into using some wipes that are primarily used in the dairy industry, but they're now being marketed to small animal veterinarians, and they're called Nissen wipes. The cattle form is given the name Wipeout. They're inexpensive. You can get them in a bucket of 500 for under $30. And sometimes using those in these dogs with chronic recurrent staph infections helps keep that bacterial load down. It's not an antibiotic, but it's an antibacterial peptide, so we don't see resistance with it. So there's just a few things that you may want to consider. Sometimes with these resistant bugs, it's really important to be working with a veterinary dermatologist as well. And if your vet can't get to the bottom of it, it's time to refer, because we want to make sure your dog stays comfortable.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks, Darcy. Yeah, appreciate the call. Darlene in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a kitten that's approximately 5 months old. I've had her for approximately 5 to 6 weeks, and when I got her, her BM was very runny, and they gave me some of this kitten chow mix to put in there, and I kind of got her on my other cat's food as soon as I could, so it had more substance, but it still tends to be very soft. Now, I brought her to my vet, and she's been on this diet canned food, and that ends today. Now, yesterday, she did get into the other cat's food, and this morning, it looks like there's runny BM again.
Okay.
Any suggestions?
Yeah. Number one, you want to try to find out why this cat's got diarrhea. I would hope that your veterinarian has not only done a fecal flotation, a check for parasites, but probably also done a look at getting what's called a Giardia antigen test done, which is looking for...
She's had that.
Okay. Yeah. And because sometimes parasites like Giardia are elusive in many cases. We may find them on a fecal flotation, the cyst form. We may get a positive back on the Giardia antigen test, but we can get false negatives where it shows up negative and they actually have it. We will often just therapeutically deworm these cats as well, especially a youngster like this. And the drug we usually use is one that's called Panacure or Fenbendazole. It's broad spectrum, and it's labeled for dogs, but very safe to use in cats. They don't see the humor in getting it because it's a liquid that doesn't taste very good. But it's 5 days out of their life, and sometimes they do get a good response to that. So that would be number one, regardless of what the stool sample has showed you. Get that, you know, just go through a therapeutic worming trial. The fact that she did well, I don't know what the type of diet your veterinarian prescribed. My guess would be probably a low-residue type diet or an intestinal tract diet that's a low-fat, low-fiber diet to kind of give the gut a rest. And if your cat did better on that, that may be a food that your cat can stay on for a longer period of time and then gradually segue over into the other pet's food. But this is just a prime example of when you have a multi-pet household, we always want to make sure that everybody, you know, owners at least, want to make sure that everybody eats the same thing. But it doesn't always go that way. Yeah. We have, you know, sometimes cats that are older that need to be on a lower calorie food. You've got a young growing kitten with gastrointestinal problems. And so this is going to be the case where you may be starting a lifetime of separate feeding stations. You may have to be looking into, you know, the little cat doors that allows one cat to get into a room where certain food is and the other one can't get in because it's, you know, keyed to their microchip or a little tag that they may wear. There's lots of tricks and things that I'm sure your veterinarian can help you with, but it may be that she may have to be on a special diet throughout her life. It's young, a 5-month-old cat, but we'll sometimes see cats with inflammatory bowel disease that may be related to a dietary intolerance, something in the food that they're allergic to. And so, you know, just I'd be, you know, maybe going back to that diet that your vet had prescribed, keeping your kitten away from the other diet, broad spectrum deworming, and then a very gradual diet change down the road to maybe something different than what your cat's getting.
There you go.
Now, what she's getting now, I mean, she's hungry all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that tends, you know, you feed her, and if you're in the kitchen, she wants more.
Yeah. And, you know, if she's not losing weight, you know, how much of that is, this is just really good? It's kind of like me with a box of chocolates. You know, I'm not even hungry, and I may still be wanting more. So, you know, is that all it is? Or is it that maybe she just isn't getting enough calories? And that, again, could be something that your veterinarian may be able to calculate out. Are we actually feeding her enough? She's a growing cat. She's maybe, you know, needing more of the current diet that she's on. So, I mean, these can be situations where we may not have a quick and easy fix. It may take some time playing with different diets until we find the right one that she tolerates. Make sure you're not giving her any milk or anything like that. That can be a problem for kittens. Many of them are lactose intolerant.
Thanks for calling, Darlene, and good luck. Appreciate your call. I want to give Lynette and Hubertus a chance to join us as well. Lynette, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. As you may have seen with the pictures that I sent,
mm-hmm.
This dog was found around September 20th, and the picture of her on the grass is right around the time she was found. She's gone through several vet visits in the home and two deworming processes. She seems to be about 6 years old. Her teeth are good. Her blood panel came back good. Everything seems to be fine health-wise, but she is not putting on any weight whatsoever. Her appetite is good. She's getting fed very small meals several times a day, 4 or 5 times a day. And this is a neighbor that found her.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I can see, she is not making any improvement whatsoever. She weighs about 12 pounds. She may have put on during this period of time 6 ounces,
okay.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And she's on a good diet,
yeah.
From what I can tell.
Yeah. These can be sometimes real tough cases to get at because we don't have any medical history on this dog. I'm glad that the dog went through some deworming. I'd be wanting to double check what they actually gave the dog to make sure that it was broad spectrum enough to get all the common parasites, and that besides just deworming, that they actually did do a stool check. I'd be looking at, does the dog have something like another parasite that can cause them to be kind of wasted, something like heartworm disease? So making sure that a blood test has been done for that as well. You know, once we've kind of ruled out those real common things, parasites and so on, or just lack of groceries, and we're making sure that they're on a high quality diet, they're getting enough calories to have them gain some weight, then we start looking at some of the more weird and wonderful things. And usually the next step I would take is to start looking at doing a gastrointestinal panel to make sure that the dog has like normal pancreas function. Pancreas is involved with digesting, giving, but supporting the gut with digestive enzymes. And there are many dogs that just will have, you know, very poor growth because they just can't digest their food properly. And that can sometimes be a fairly easy thing to treat with a pancreatic enzyme supplement, but it means getting some blood work. And usually it gets sent off to a lab in Texas to be able to look at this stuff. The other thing that comes to mind too is sometimes when we've had dogs that have been chronically starved, there is this thing that's called starvation syndrome, where their gut has just been so badly damaged that they just never gain weight, or it's a very, very slow process. And so, I'd kind of be looking at the dog as the entire package. And if she's happy, her stool's normal, she's, you know, eating and will it actually want to eat more, then, keep working down that line and just see, you know, is it just a matter of we just need more time and, you know, having her be de-stressed and so on to be able to get some of those pounds back on the dog. But how good of your neighbor to take this dog in? But I have a feeling we need to do a little more research to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Lynette.
Thank you so much.
Jackie in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm not going to talk. I lost my other dog on the 17th.
Oh.
What I'm calling about, though, is I've read in some of my dog magazines that there is a way of spaying female dogs without removing the uterus,
right?
Just the ovaries,
right? Right, and that's called an ovariectomy. Our standard spay or variohysterectomy that we do is involving a more major surgery that involves removing the ovaries and the uterus. And that's kind of been the classic thing that's been done in the veterinary world. And there was just a really good article published looking at, are we putting dogs more at risk of having that uterus being left in? Probably the only thing would be the potential for uterine tumors, which are very rare in dogs. Once the ovaries are removed, the chance of getting like a uterine infection, like a pyometra, is virtually non-existent. And so at the veterinary school, one of the things that we do is we offer, besides the standard spay, which is opening up the abdomen, removing the ovaries and uterus, we do offer laparoscopic ovariectomies, where the uterus is left in and the dog has a couple of small incisions, and it's done with a laparoscope. The ovaries are removed. The nice thing about that is the dog can return to normal activity much faster. There's less potential for complications with that abdominal incision. And sometimes for some of these dogs, you can also at the same time do a procedure if they're prone to bloat. You can do a gastropexy where their stomach is tacked to their abdominal wall. And so sometimes we do all that when they're having the laparoscopic surgery done. Of course, a gastropexy can also be done with a standard spay. But again, this is just a kind of a cultural thing in the veterinary world. We got to remove that ovary and uterus. But the evidence is out there that just removing the ovaries, it would be fine for many, many, many dogs just because uterine cancer is such a rare occurrence.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Jackie, sorry for
your loss. I know it's
very hard.
It's tough, but you know, I'm already looking into potentially, Mark, if you're listening, I got an email today from a friend, actually Vanna, my other bulldog's former owner, that there is a 10-year-old bulldog that is looking for a home. The family can't care for him, and the daughter, who is on maternity leave, is caring for the dog. And I am seriously thinking about giving them a call. Vanna really needs a dog, and this is a male, and it's 10, and my house is designed for arthritic old bulldogs because we've got ramps and baby gates and everything up. And since it's kind of considered not at that great adoption age, I may be coming in the next month with some stories on a new boy in my life. I don't know yet, but stay tuned. Yeah.
Can you still hear me?
Yes.
I made a list of good stuff, bad, and the bad was for him. So I had him put down.
Yeah. You're yeah. welcome. And, you know, that is the hardest thing, is how much are we keeping that pet around because it's so hard for us to make the decision versus, you know, what we're doing for the pet. And it's the best gift we can give when the pet is ready. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so grateful that as a profession, we have that ability. And if I didn't, I don't think I could practice the same as I do, because it's seeing suffering as we sometimes see in the human world, where pet, you know, owners are not owners, patients are, you know, mm-hmm. kept alive at great expense. And it's like, for who? So, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss, but you did the best thing for your pet.
Yeah. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you very much for calling. And Catherine in Wausau, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you. Good show, always. I have two cats. One is 13 and the other is 7. And the 7, the 13-year-old is thin, and the 7 is short and stout and is a little bit overweight, maybe about, he weighs 13 pounds, is neutered. They've been on the same Blue Buffalo cat food.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was told to try different weight management, so I went to neutral for the overweight cat.
Mm-hmm.
And
what else can we do?
Yeah, well, you know, this is again the classic thing where you've got a skinny cat and a fat cat. They have to eat separately. I mean, you can't have one diet that both are going to eat. I'm going to have you go. There's a device that's being sold online, and it's something that you could make yourself with a translucent storage bin and one of the little cat doors. But if you go to, it's called Meow, like the cat meow, space. That, if you just Google that, you'll see there's these plexiglass boxes that you can put, the skinny cat can have food available all the time because they can go into the box, they can eat, but the other cat can't get in. And you can actually very simply make one yourself once you see how it's made. I'm sure if you're a little bit handy, you'd be able to do it. But weight loss is really a no-brainer. It's less calories and more exercise. And in the case of a cat, following your veterinarian's advice with what we call a Catkins diet, a low carbohydrate, low fat, high protein diet, seems to boost their metabolism and help them lose weight. But you want to do it gradually, make diet changes gradually, and you know it's hard to find ways to exercise your cat. You sometimes have to be inventive, like if they like to play fetch, running up and down the stairs, toys on strings and wands and so on. Those are all things that are going to help get that metabolism up and have those pounds start coming off. But go about it slowly and under your veterinarian supervision. So good for you for working on this. Over 50% of pets in the last National Obesity Awareness Day, we've surpassed that 50% rate of obesity in our pets.
Thank you very much for calling. We're talking about all this passing away and illnesses. I did want to mention that Noel Cutright, who has been a guest on this program for years and years, passed away on Sunday evening. He had cancer. He, Bill Volkert was talking about it. I think they did more than 70 programs with me and with Judith and Jim Packard, too, going back that far. They were on this program to talk about birds on pretty much every holiday. So they were our holiday programs. And Noel, just a wonderful guy. He had an amazing knowledge of birds. He could stick his head out the window and he could tell you all the birds that were out there just by the sounds of their voices. And as wife said as well, he could even tell you how many cardinals were out there at the same time or how many other birds. He was really a wonderful guy. He took part in hundreds of annual Christmas bird counts. He was a member, of course, of the National Audubon Society. He marked more than 30 years of collecting federal breeding bird survey data. His His breeding bird atlas is certainly that he, the Atlas of Breeding Birds of Wisconsin, really. He was the senior editor of that book, and he was, that was published in 2006. It's the book. It's the atlas. So Noel is going to really be missed. Bill Volkert will be, will be with us on Thanksgiving Day with Judith, and there'll probably be another tear or two shed on that day as well. And Sandy, I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, well, thank you. And, you know, the legacy that he left behind with all the information that he shared over the years is just, you know, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And we posted, Judith's posted his obit and story on our Facebook page. So you can go to the Larry Mueller Show and learn some more about Noel Cutright. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.